popular topics that I've talked about in both the blog and the podcast is cartridge comparisons, talking about the 270 versus the 30-06, and
yeah,
the 6.5 Creedmoor versus everything, and all of that stuff. And,
yeah.
And you know, when I was first getting started, and even before I got started doing this, getting on social media, getting on hunting forums, that sort of thing, I saw that there was a lot of people that I think were just genuinely confused about a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know any better.
Welcome back to Wild Game Dynasty's podcast, episode number 105. Yes, folks, 105. We really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule and choosing to get a gold nugget out of our podcast. And that's our goal, is to have a gentleman or a lady on our podcast that has a particular fun item, fun topic, fun to do, something that we can garner, whether it be just entertainment or maybe a learning how to or a better enjoy the out of doors. Well, this episode is no exception. John, our ballistics expert, he acquired that knowledge right from really his father when he was growing up, and then on to the military, and then he retired from the military, and he continues to grow his knowledge. He's definitely a ballistic expert. You'll garner that when you listen to this podcast. But he's also a hunter, an avid hunter that's hunted worldwide, and he studied ballistics through his hunting experiences. Yes, folks, his desire is to team up the right cartridge, the right caliber, with the type of hunting that we're doing. That's his goal. Reason being, minimum meat loss, minimum damage, but maximum clean harvest to the animal that we're harvesting. Hey, without further ado, let's roll it into podcast episode number 105. John McAdams, this is Gary Morgan calling.
Hey, good morning, Gary. It's great to talk to you.
Hey, you as well. I really appreciate you reaching out to me. I want to let the listeners know that you reached out to me, and you're a fellow podcaster, fellow blogger in the hunting, or the, maybe I call it the outdoor recreation arena, but we emailed and texted back and forth, and we had a nice conversation this morning, and I really appreciate that. But it's always nice to, man, have a mutual beneficial conversation, and I think that will, as a topic of today, but you have some things that you want to talk about that I think my listeners are going to really appreciate. You have an expertise that you want to share, and why don't you explain a little tiny bit of that to the listeners, and then we'll kind of expand from there.
Yeah, sure thing. So I originally grew up in the suburbs of Houston, Texas, and grew up hunting in East Texas, not far from the Louisiana border out here in the Piney Woods. So this is a very different part of Texas. It looks very different from what a lot of people that have never been to Texas picture Texas being. You know, you picture cactuses and maybe mesquite trees and things like that. But out here, being so close to Louisiana, this is the Piney Woods, and it looks a lot like a lot of Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, all that sort of thing. And there's a lot of really good deer hunting out here. And like I said, that's where I grew up, and
yeah,
where I grew up hunting anyway. And I traveled all over the country when I was in the Army, hunting in a lot of the different duty stations where I was assigned, and got some interesting experiences kind of all over the country, seeing just different things and how things were done differently and in those various other states, and how it was the same as Texas too. It was also interesting as well. But in any case, I got out of the Army in 2014, moved back to Texas here recently, and got into the outdoor industry, like you said, when I made that transition. And I wrote freelance for a couple of different publications over the years, as well as starting my own blog, the Big Game Hunting Blog, and my own podcast, the Big Game Hunting Podcast. And in those outlets that I created for myself, I talk a lot about a lot of the things that I'm most interested in, and where I saw at least the most need that wasn't being fulfilled already. And one of the most popular topics that I've talked about in in both the blog and the podcast is cartridge comparisons, talking about the 270 versus the 30-06 and the 6.5 Creedmoor versus everything and all of that stuff. And you know, when I was first getting started, or and even before I got started doing this, getting on social media, getting on hunting forums, that sort of thing, I saw that there was a lot of people that I think were just genuinely confused about a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know any better. And I think there was a lot of people that didn't know any better that were spreading bad information on there and kind of making the situation worse.
Yeah.
And I know that was really frustrating for a lot of people that were, that they didn't know any better and they were trying to get onto these places and try and get information. Hey, I'm trying to buy a new rifle. What should I get? I heard the 308 was good. I heard the 270 was good. And what I wanted to do was create a no baloney, straight down the middle resource. Hey, we're going to talk about these things. This is what they're good for. This is what they're not good for. Having that information now, you can make a decision on what is best for you based upon what you want to do, what your budget is, that sort of thing. And it's really snowballed over the last few years, and it's I've been pretty successful doing it. I really enjoy it, had a lot of fun, got to connect with a lot of interesting people like you doing that, and so here we are today.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that summary, because that really resonates to a lot of people. Ballistics, as you know, is a, I don't want to, you know, no pun intended, it's a hot topic, and it has been and probably will continue to be for who knows however long, but there's a lot of opinions out there, and unfortunately, some of that is and everybody, it's neat to have opinions and neat to have an open perspective on things, so we can come down to, whittle down to maybe what is best, or what is, you know, in the top 10 or the top 5, and certainly just because it's not number 1, it, you know, number 2 might be darn close, and, you know, coming in second place is not a bad thing. But certainly matching the cartridge, the caliber, to the type of task at hand, we'll call it the hunting task, whether they're deer hunting, whether they're trying to reduce the woodchuck population, certainly there's a difference in round selection. And sometimes it's a bad selection, sometimes it's just not the best selection, we'll say. But I'm really really eager to hear your opinion on this and garner some gold nuggets out of this. And I think a lot of people need to hear, you know, get rid of the clutter and hear from someone that, such as yourself, that has some really good information out there and that can declutter this for people that are getting ready to go out and buy an additional, hunting rifle or buy their first one, or, you know, maybe trade up what they've got and trade into a buy something that's more appropriate to what they're choosing to go out and harvest.
Yeah, definitely. You know, choosing the right cartridge, matching that to the job, and choosing a rifle that is appropriate for those things as well is extremely important. And in that same vein, your specific ammunition load, you know, that your bullet weight, bullet type, all of that stuff is very, very important. You know, I joke around about the 6.5 Creedmoor all the time. I have one. I enjoy hunting with it, all that stuff, and it's good for certain things. But it also gets a lot of hate, you know, for various reasons as well that, you know, necessarily need to get into here today. There are certain things I think it's good for. There are certain things I think it's not good for.
Right.
But I will tell you, say I would rather hunt an elk with a 6.5 Creedmoor using a really, really good bullet instead of, say, a 300 Win Mag using a really, really bad bullet for hunting elk. And so that's something that also gets lost in the clutter there as well. Like, the rifle's important, the cartridge is important, but your bullet is also the thing that actually hits the animal, and that actually kills it. And so that's, like, perhaps the most single important piece of the equation here that really gets overlooked.
Yeah.
And it's important for quickly and ethically killing the animal, and at the same time, doing it in a way that does not ruin excessive amounts of, does not ruin excessive amounts of meat.
Boy, you hit the nail on the head there. I had a buddy of mine that ran into a guy that hand-loaded, and through this, we'll call it the pandemic, the shortage of ammo. Of course, we still have pockets of shortages, and it's coming back. Well, anyways, that's for another day, like you say. But he ran into a buddy, or he developed a friendship of a person that hand loaded, and my buddy said, "Hey, I have learned more from that guy, and why he, you know, he doesn't hand load a dozen different types. He wants to know what your caliber is, what you're hunting. He's asking those same questions, that hand loader that you're asking for, so he can hand a box of ammo over to the purchaser, to the client that's going to go out and probably harvest an animal, making sure that that bullet is the best best bullet design for the caliber that he's using."
Yeah, definitely. And many, many hand loaders are excellent resources for this stuff as well, just because they have that more intimate connection with the cartridge doing that work, choosing the specific bullet, your specific powder, how much powder that you're using, all of that stuff, trying to get it to shoot accurately and deliver the performance on actual game downrange that you want.
Yeah. So on your blog and on your podcast, how were you able to reach out to interested people or people that should be considering some of this data, particularly on, you know, choosing the right type of bullet or choosing the right caliber as well? How were you able to reach out? And because some people, you know, it's funny. It's, you know, somebody drives a Chevrolet and they think a Ford just is awful. And then, you know, but it's funny how people are with their rifle cartridges as well. To get someone to change or to consider, how are you able to do that?
That is a good question. And there was a guy that I interviewed on my podcast once named Phil Macero. You know, he writes for a bunch of different publications like the NRA and that sort of thing. And,
yep. And
I remember him saying one time that you would probably be better off insulting someone's mother than you would insulting their favorite hunting cartridge. And that's definitely how a lot of people look at that. And I get a lot of flack on that sometimes. And but there was a comparison that I did once on the 7mm Remington Magnum versus the 300 Win Mag. And of those two cartridges, I personally prefer the 300 Win Mag, and that is what I hunt with of those two. But I remember going out of my way in that article, as I'm going to really try and do my best to make this a fair and balanced, unbiased article and that stuff, and pay attention, pay particular attention to the strengths of the 7mm Magnum and that sort of thing. And it is really funny the number of comments that I got on that article. "Oh my God, you're clearly in the tank for the 7mag. You know, you need to check your bias and all that stuff."
Yeah.
So maybe I did such a good job of doing that I went a little too far the other direction. But in general, I will tell you that people, especially people that don't necessarily have a dog in this fight, that they want to go elk hunting and they want to go deer hunting, and man, I've heard these cartridges are really good, which one should I look at? I kind of lay it out. Hey, these are the different bullet weights and bullet types that are available in it. This is, and I'll lay them out side by side too. This is the trajectory and energy of these bullets and these cartridges compared to each other. And you can see, right, you know, it drops this much at this range. You have this much kinetic energy remaining at this range, that sort of thing. And so you can see for yourself.
Yeah,
same thing
absolutely.
With wind drift, same thing with recoil. Here are the number of ammo options that you have. You know, so, oh man, both these cartridges are really popular, and so you got a lot of different options for them, this sort of thing. Or if in other comparisons, man, well, this one is a little bit more of a niche cartridge, and so even though it may perform more appropriately or, you know, quote-unquote better in other areas, your ammo options are limited. So that's something to keep in mind, that it may be harder for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I do that, I found that people that really come into it with an open mind, which is most people I found, they respond really well to it. And you're always going to get some people that don't like the comparison for whatever reason, especially if you especially if you say some not nice things about your favorite cartridge. And,
yeah. And
I don't, you know, I'm not rude about it or any of that. They're like, well, listen, like if these two cartridges in this situation, this one's better than that one.
Yeah.
And you know, my father-in-law said once too, he's like, gosh, you know, the the mean things people say about me that are true are the ones that hurt the most, and I found that's the case in this as well.
Yeah, but you have an open mind, and you're asking for people to do the same. I don't know. It's like these statements that our elders make, like your one that your father-in-law made, and that hits home right there. I remember talking to somebody about trying to pass a school board election in your local community. Don't waste your time with the ones that aren't going to vote in your favor or in your perspective from the beginning. Walk by them and only hit up the ones that are undecided or the ones that you got to remind them to vote. In this case, if there's somebody that's going to be just, a naysayer on the advice that you're giving them, okay. But the neat thing about it is, just what you said earlier, there are people that are still undecided or that are asking for professional advice. And for that reason and that reason alone, I think it's pretty cool that you're reaching out to a number of people, letting them kind of refine their decision. And if nothing else, maybe don't pick a certain type of situation, caliber or bullet, that maybe they got some misinformation from some other source that just was well-intended and just it wasn't adding up. But for that reason, I think that that's pretty cool that you're reaching out to quite a few people, a lot of people that are asking for advice. They're wanting your opinion, and that's the people that we want to talk to anyways. So
absolutely. If you're doing a Google search for 6.5 Creedmoor versus 308, for instance, that person might be trying to pick a fight,
yeah.
But it's more likely that they are just genuinely curious what the difference is between those two cartridges are.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, the person that's never going to change their mind, it's not to say I'm going to cease and desist my contacts with them, but if it's, I'm not in it to pick a fight. I'm in it to share information. And for you to have that expertise and to share that back to people, that's a great thing. And that's what people are reaching out, looking for additional information, help them make that decision, to be a better hunter out in the woods, to be a more responsible hunter. And which leads into the next thing, really, is, I shouldn't say the next thing, but we kind of scenarioed this before we press the proverbial record button. I have a friend of the family, lives about an hour north of me, that has a side thing, a side gig, I call it. It's not a paid gig, but he is I call him sharpshooter. There are some farmers, some pretty good-sized farmers, that have a lot of crop damage. And depending on the ebb and flow of the population of the white-tailed deer in that area, right now there's a pretty good number. And the Department of Natural Resources evaluates that, and they want to reduce the herd or reduce the number of white-tails for a number of reasons, but not just for crop damage, disease management, etc. So he gets hired by the farmers, or the farm permits get handed over to him. So he'll shoot 80 plus whitetails. And it's really interesting to pick his brain to say, hey, what's your favorite rifle? When I asked that, he didn't respond back to say it's this. He responded back, and I think one of them is his 300 Win Mag, but it wasn't just the rifle. It was just like you said, he was very careful to tell me exactly what caliber what bullet that his favorite performer. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, based off how far out the deer are at most of the time, that's the caliber that I've deemed that I've had the most success for with the least amount of damage to the deer, to the white-tailed deers. He said it provides a clean kill, but not a lot of collateral damage to the meat. Because he's given that meat away. He's yet to, I shouldn't say waste an animal, but he says, hey, I'll shoot 4, 5, 6, 7, not every night, but when I do go out there a couple, 3 times a week. And he said, by the time I get home, I've made a few phone calls. I've already got people lined up to stop by and get a free, some free venison the next morning. Because he cleans them up, and he's got a walk-in cooler. He's set up pretty good, so he would be probably very interested in hear this podcast. So when we're done, I'm gonna text him and tell him, hey, he's he didn't realize that he was a starring role in our podcast today.
You know, that, and so tell us a little bit about the specific circumstances that he is shooting these deer under. You said it's agricultural stuff, so shooting them in bigger fields, a little bit longer range shots?
Yeah, I'm suspecting without asking him those specifics, although I think I've heard him talk openly about it, they're probably a soybean field, and soybeans are, you know, pretty well selected by the white-tailed deer, especially this time of year when they start podding up. And that's when he gets the permits, when those start podding up, because they'll wipe out, you know, a number of rows of soybeans. So he positions himself not to be in an area where they're coming out of the timber. So they're going to come out of some timber out into an open bean field. And I know he talked about his shot selection as far as distance from where he's sitting is about 2, 2 1/4. He says he can reach out 3, 3 1/4 without an effort, but he says he knows he can take that shot safely, humanely, and without with minimal meat damage. So that's his story.
Okay. So I'll share a personal story of my own here to help us get started, and then I'll outline a couple of different principles that people need to pay attention to, and then we can tie all that stuff into the story of your friend with his deer control here.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Like I told you, I grew up hunting out in East Texas, and in those piney woods, it's not super duper thick, but it's pretty thick. Longer range shots are uncommon there. I've shot most of my deer under 50 yards and very few over 100 yards in that area. And so that is a very important thing to keep in mind. And it informs your rifle, cartridge, and bullet choice, because it's close range hunting like that. And for that reason, I did a lot of hunting with iron-sighted lever-action rifles growing up. And
yeah.
In particular, I shot with a lot of deer with a Marlin 1895 and 4570.
Nice.
Which worked great out there. And so we had a little shooting range up there, and I was shooting one day during deer season, checking zero or whatever, and a guy came up to the range from, there's a hunting lease down the road from us that we're not a part of, but we shared this range with these guys and have a good relationship with them. And this guy came up, and he was shooting a little bit too, and I was chatting with him, and he was asking me what I was shooting. And I said, well, I'm shooting a 45-70. And he says, oh, man, I don't like using a 45-70. I said, well, why is that? He said, man, it ruins way too much meat. And I said, well, okay, what are you shooting? He said, well, I'm shooting a 300 Remington Ultra Magnum. I said, oh, okay. And so for those that don't know, a 300 Remington Ultra Magnum is like a 300 Win Mag on steroids. And so
yes,
it'll shoot the same weight bullet a couple hundred feet per second faster than that 300 Win Mag. And so you can shoot a 180-grain bullet over 3,000 feet per second out of a 300 Ultra Mag. And that's really fast.
Yeah, that's smoking hot.
The funny thing is that he unintentionally highlighted a common misconception with regards to meat loss that a lot of people get wrong. And as it turns out, things were exactly opposite of what this guy thought was the case here. And he was probably using one of the worst cartridges and bullets that he could be using on deer in that area, as far as minimizing collateral damage on a white-tailed deer goes.
Yeah.
If he was hunting, say, a longer range, 300-400-yard shots, more common, and or on bigger game, if he was hunting elk or moose or something like that, then a 300 Ultra Mag is great. And, you know, it's one of these things that I would say that there are few bad cartridges, but there are inappropriate situations or situations where a cartridge is less than ideal. And I would say shooting a white-tailed deer at really close range with a super high-velocity cartridge like that is not ideal.
No, I agree.
And so this is a case. So the first thing to keep in mind when it comes to minimizing meat loss on your animal is shot placement. And that's important for two reasons. One, you want to make a good, quick kill on the animal so that, one, it doesn't escape. So if you wound and lose the animal, then your meat loss is 100%.
Yep.
Everything on that animal got away and you got none of it. By the same token, if you shoot and wound that animal and eventually kill it, and it takes a long time for it to die and you can't find it, or it takes you a day or two to find it and you've lost all or some of the meat due to spoilage, that is also not ideal. And
yeah.
at the same time, if you gut shoot the animal or something like that, and even if you find it quickly, you may have some of the meat that's ruined due to contamination from the stomach or the intestines or something like that. All of those things are not ideal.
Correct.
What we want to avoid.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100% there.
At the same time, too, there's also places on an animal where you're just going to ruin more meat from the bullet hitting there. It can't ruin meat if it doesn't hit it. And so there are some places on the body where there's just more meat than there are others. The hams and the shoulders are two places where there's lots and lots of meat concentrated right there.
Yeah.
There's meat on the ribs, but there's less of it there. And so
mm-hmm.
that is a case where, especially, say, if you have a quartering away shot where you're able to sneak your bullet in, say, behind one shoulder, and it exits, say, in front of the other shoulder, something like that, and where you hit the vitals, hit the heart and lungs, and miss both shoulders, that's great, because
yeah.
then, assuming that you used an appropriate cartridge and bullet for that shot, that deer's probably not going to run very far at all. You're probably going to find it easily and quickly, and it did not destroy, you know, large amounts of meat on the big meat concentrated areas, like on the shoulders.
Yes.
You can also shoot the animal in the head or in the neck, but those are dicey shots.
Well,
you know,
right.
there's less meat to ruin there, but it's also really easy to screw it up, too.
Yeah,
and wound and lose your animal. And so,
absolutely.
At least on a deer, I don't think it's a good idea to be shooting animals there.
No, even on a bear, I mean, you know, we preach that. Some people say, well, I've read, you know, so there are publications, there are people that are promoting that. But I would agree with you. Not a good shot selection at all on a deer or a bear or, in my opinion, most animals.
If it is a very close range shot and you've got a really accurate rifle and a hunter that really knows what the heck he or she is doing, then, okay, maybe you can do it. But it's, I said, generally it's not a good idea, especially on a deer. Because if you think about a deer, right, they'll stand there, they'll put their head down, they'll eat for a second, and then they'll pop their head back up and look around and then put their head back down and eat. So that head is always moving.
Yeah.
And even if their head is moving, their shoulders and their body are staying, for the most part, pretty stationary. And so it's a good target that is easier to hit, and it's a lot bigger.
Yeah.
A feral hog is a little bit different, and that's a case where a neck or a head shot is more popular, and it can still be really effective because they don't have that long neck like a deer does, and so
right.
it's not moving around as much. And so it is a more difficult shot than a body shot with them, but it's something that is easier on a deer.
Yeah.
But just know that it's that while you may be losing less meat from your actual bullet damage to the animal, even in a case of a feral hog or even a bear, it's a case where you're increasing your risk of wounding and losing the animal and losing the meat that way, or something to that effect.
You bet. Absolutely.
But just realize, so one, your first priority here is shot placement. And if you can take a shot that hits the vitals and hits them well without hitting the shoulders, then that is a way that you can do that. So behind the shoulder, if it's broadside or slightly quartering away. A quartering two shot can be more challenging because oftentimes you'll need to shoot straight through one of the shoulders to reach the vitals. And so if you have time and you have the ability to do so, and the situation is appropriate for doing so, then that is something to keep in mind there. And that will work with almost any acceptable cartridge for hunting the game that you're after. And even with, say, a 300 Ultra Mag, if you have a good quartering away shot and you're able to sneak the bullet in behind the shoulder like that, then it's probably going to kill that animal quickly without destroying as much meat as it would through the shoulders.
Yeah.
Now, next principle, though, like I alluded to earlier, is bullet velocity. This is a case where I think a lot of people get mixed up. And this is why cartridges like the 3030 and the 4570 in particular are so popular with deer hunters in parts of the country, especially, say, out east where shot distances are a little bit closer.
Yeah.
Every now and then you talk to someone, you'll hear they'll say something to the effect that, yeah, you can eat right up to the hole on the animal, quote-unquote, like that. And they're exaggerating, but not a lot.
Right, I would agree with that. When you were talking about the 4570, when you introduced that into your conversation, you said, you know, the lever actions. I thought for sure you're going to say 30-30, and then you said 4570, and I thought, not a big difference. Yeah.
Nope. It all depends on the exact load that you're talking about here, but in most cases, that 4570 is going to be shooting a heavier, larger diameter bullet several hundred feet per second slower than the 30-30.
Yeah.
But in each case, we're talking about a pretty low velocity round. You know, depending on the exact load that you're talking about with the 4570, you know, you're shooting, say, 1,300 feet per second to 2,000 feet per second. And with the 30-30, you know, 2,300 feet per second, something like that at the muzzle.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, those are very low velocities compared to a 300 Win Mag or a 300 Ultra Mag, something like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in Michigan, particularly the northern half of the lower peninsula and the upper peninsula, I think a lot of hunters, particularly back in the day, cut their teeth on a 30-30, and were quite pleased with the harvest that it provided, and then for some reason, you know, 30-30 kind of lost its lack, it kind of had lackluster, I guess, and then all of a sudden everybody seemingly became a ballistics expert. With a couple of boxes of ammo in their gun locker, and that's it. But they were experts, and so they start switching over to 7 mags and different things, 300 Win Mags, still shooting, you know, 60, 70 yards tops in the big timber. And I thought,
and that can lead to an example of you'll probably still kill the deer really well, and you know, the old saying is, right, oh, at what point are you overgunned, right? You know, dead is dead, and that's
right.
True, but there's more recoil with those cartridges, ammo is more expensive with them, you got more muzzle blast with them, and then in many cases, depends once again on the exact load, like we'll get into here in a second, but in many cases, you're going to be losing more meat with those cartridges because
they have
a higher velocity.
You bet. I mean, so, look at what's happened now with the design of, I was going to say the Ruger, but I mean, they kind of introduced it. I'm getting off on a tangent. I'm sorry, but the 450, the, you know, Bushmaster, the 350 Legend, particularly that 450, boy, that has become a lot of people's fan favorite. But at the same time, you look at the ballistics, and some people have no clue, you know, that they look at the chart and they kind of shake their head. No, that's not true. I said, hey, that is exactly it, buddy. That's not my ballistics. That's the ballistic provided by the manufacturer of the gun that you bought in that 450 caliber.
Yeah, that's right. So for the listener that doesn't know, 450 Bushmaster, you're shooting, say, a 250 grain bullet around 2,200 feet per second, something like that. So big, relatively heavy, slow bullet, and the disadvantages of cartridges like the 4570, the 3030, 450 Bushmaster, the 350 Legend as well, is they don't have great performance at long range.
Correct.
But going back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, you need to match what you're using to the situation.
Yeah.
And so, no, I would not try and shoot an elk at 400 yards with a 450 Bushmaster. A whitetail deer at 100 yards, that's a situation where it's going to probably very effectively kill that deer. It's not going to destroy your shoulder, and it's with a low to moderate impact velocity like that, you're not going to just have just tons and tons of bloodshot meat on it either.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. In Michigan, we have an elk season, but it's, you know, it's big timber elk hunting. It's a very limited season. It's by draw, so the DNR issues about 200 or so tags, 100 in the first season in the early fall, and 100 in December. And you see a lot of these 450s coming up there, and they think, well, we're hunting, you know, 100 yards. The problem is the hunters fail to kind of look at the thing and say, hey, you don't know where you're going to find that elk. You may find them out in one of those open fields at 250 yards, and you've got that 450 in your hands, and you're asking that gun to do something that it really isn't designed to do. And you should not be considering pulling the trigger on that, because it's just not fair. And, you know, I had a buddy of mine that was guiding elk, and he had a guy that bought his 450 Bushmaster just to come up elk hunting. And he told the guy, put that away. We're not doing that. I know we're hunting, and you got to trust me to get your, I think it was a 270 he got out of the gun case. And he said, that's more appropriate to what we got. I'd rather have you brought a different caliber altogether, but that's going to be more appropriate than that 450. So what happens? He shoots the elk at about 60 yards. Yeah. Oh yeah. Because that's what the opportunity came and arrived, you know? So, oh man, I talked to John and he says, hey, I still stick to my decision. I said, oh, I agree with 100%. Unfortunately, we just can't carry, you know, more than one gun in our hands. And, you don't know what your opportunity is going to be. Might be an open field at 300 yards. It might be in some timber at about 60 yards.
Yeah, definitely true. And tying this back into what we were talking about earlier, your bullet impact velocity is very important. And I'm talking about impact velocity, not your muzzle velocity. The bullet's going to slow down when it leaves the muzzle, and you know it'll be hitting at a lower velocity than what it is than you shot it. How much depends on the exact bullet and the range that you're talking about. There's not going to be a big difference at 50 or 60 yards, but you're going to lose a couple hundred feet per second at 100, 200 yards, that sort of thing, depending on the bullet. As far as meat loss goes, I've found, and I've seen this myself anecdotally, and I've kind of confirmed this with other people that have had similar experiences, when you have impact velocities over about 2,600, 2,700 feet per second, that is when you can get a lot of bloodshot, ruined meat around where the bullet hits on the animal. And so that's why people joke about the 30-30, where you can eat right up to the hole because you've got, say, a 2,000 or 2,100 foot per second impact velocity. It's going to bore a hole straight through that animal, and it's going to mushroom and cause a lot of tissue damage, but it's not going to have, say, like a 3 or 4 inch diameter circle around that hole where the meat is ruined as well.
You're so correct on that. I like how you explain that out, how you describe that. I got the word picture, and I agree with you 100% on that.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, too, you know, when the bullet hits at a high impact velocity like that, and to a lesser extent, this happens at lower impact velocities, but it's most apparent at higher ones. When you're using a lead core bullet, which is most bullets out there, you're going to have little tiny pieces of lead that are radiating out from the bullet path in all directions. And that will cause more tissue damage and all of that stuff. And especially as it goes through the vitals, it can help kill the animal more quicker or, you know, faster by causing more damage there. But that also just ruins more meat as it goes through the animal as well. And you're just going to have, like I said, those little tiny pieces of lead that are 1 grain or less, or, you know, microscopic. You may not even be able to see them with your eye. You may only be able to see them if you took an x-ray of the meat, but they're there. And that's what kind of also causes a lot of that bloodshot area around the animal.
Very interesting.
Around the actual wound on it.
Very interesting. Kind of explain that, though, if you can expand on what kind of, I mean, I know there's a million scenarios out there, but under that scenario that you painted that picture on, what should somebody consider to minimize that bloodshot, minimize those fragments? What kind of a bullet design should somebody be considering that's still a clean kill and a rapid kill, but also, you know, it's kind of the best of both worlds, I guess, but, you know, minimum meat loss, minimum meat damage.
Sure, and actually kind of leads into my next point. So at this point, we talked about shot placement. We talked about impact velocity. Next thing is bullet construction. So most bullets, like I said, are a lead core on them. So some, you know, for some cartridges, say like the 4570, you may just have like a solid lead cast bullet. Most bullets, though, have a lead core with a something like a copper jacket around them.
Yes.
When the bullet hits that copper jacket, and the lead will peel back, and it will, that's what we call mushrooming or expanding. And
yes.
So you have a 30 caliber bullet as it goes in, and as it expands from impact, receiving resistance from hitting bone and muscle and that sort of thing, the frontal diameter of that bullet will increase. And so, say you shoot it with a 30 caliber bullet, it may increase to twice its diameter, so it may be 60 caliber by the time it's done expanding there.
Okay.
In many cases, say especially with a softer bullet, like I said, just a traditional cup and core bullet like your Hornady SST,
mm-hmm.
Winchester PowerPoint, Remington Corlock, that sort of thing, the lead is just, it's just inside the jacket, and it will come out of it as it expands, and those, you know, like I said, you'll have those fragments that kind of go everywhere. There are some bullets that are what's called bonded bullets, where that lead is chemically attached to the jacket in one way or another.
Okay.
It's more difficult to do that. It's more expensive, et cetera, et cetera. But in any case, those bullets, though, are they will have more weight retention than an identical bullet, say the same weight, same impact velocity, that sort of thing, that is just a traditional cup and core bullet. That matters because weight retention is how much the bullet weighs at the end, you know, after it's come to rest in the animal or wherever it comes to rest versus when you shoot it. So if you have a 200 grain bullet and when you shoot it and then you recover it later inside that animal and it weighs 100 grains, you had 50% weight retention. And so that 100 grains of lead is somewhere, and it's usually inside that animal at some point in the muscles or whatever.
Okay.
A bonded bullet will have higher weight retention. You may have 70 or 80% or even higher, depending on the details of it there. And so the bullet usually will still expand, but all of that stuff will still be contained in the bullet itself. You can take it out, put it on a scale, whatever. And the same thing is true even if you don't recover the bullet. But bottom line, what I'm saying is you're going to have less fragments kind of going in every direction on a tougher bullet, especially if that bullet is bonded.
Yeah. Well,
the next step up is what's called a monolithic bullet, or something that is lead-free. Barnes makes these bullets. Hornady E-Tip is one. Or excuse me, not Hornady E-Tip, Nossler E-Tip. Almost everyone makes some sort of a lead-free bullet these days. Those bullets are usually solid copper or some sort of a copper alloy. They're lead-free. And in those cases, you will usually have 100% weight retention.
Wow.
I've shot many, many animals with solid copper or lead-free bullets, and all of the ones that I've recovered have been like 98, 99% weight retention. They still mushroom beautifully, kill really well, but they, like I said, you know, all that weight is still in the actual bullet. Nothing gets left in the animal, and there's literally no lead in them, so you can't have any lead contamination
in that
respect either.
John, I guess I got to ask, though, the proverbial question is, what's the downside? And I assume there's at least one.
Yeah, and that's there's actually a couple. So one, those bullets are usually more expensive.
In a percentage-wise, are they 10% higher, 50% higher, or are they considerably more?
Gosh, you know, it really depends. And so we're living in some kind of weird times right now. And
yep.
So, you know, as everyone's noticed, ammo is harder to find, and what you can find is more expensive than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that the highest price increases have been with the stuff that was the cheapest to begin with. So, or excuse me, like the highest percentage price increase. So, the Winchester PowerPoint, Remington Corlock, all that stuff that used to be, you could get it for under $20 a box sometimes, and maybe double that now, you know. The premium ammo, the bonded stuff, and then the lead-free stuff has also increased in price, but the gap the amount that they've increased is smaller. So the gap in price between them is less than it used to be. The details vary, but say with something like Winchester makes a subline of their deer season XP ammo called the Copper Impact. That is, you know, it's copper bullets, but it's designed and marketed for deer hunters. That is usually the least expensive lead-free ammo that I can find. And so you're talking, say, depending on the cartridge, $30 to $40 a box with that. And so it is definitely, say, more expensive than the regular Winchester Deer Season XP, but we're not talking twice as expensive.
Right.
Now, you'd have to look it up on Cabela's or whatever, see what the details of it are, but say something like Barnes or Federal Premium with their Trophy Copper, it can be, you know, quite a bit more expensive. You may be paying $50 or $60 for a box of ammo like that. And so, yeah, that is a big thing to keep in mind, especially if you're a high-volume shooter or if you're just on a more strict budget, that sort of thing as well.
Well, if we talk about the average hunter, I'm looking at the average hunter that I'm familiar with in Michigan, and, you know, I'm kind of probably prejudging a little bit, but they probably don't shoot their hunting rifle a whole lot, but almost all of them will certainly take it to the range before they come to the woods, to the field, whatever, and they may shoot until they're satisfied that their optics are still on, that it's hitting the target as they would expect. But what if someone buys that ammo and switches over from, say, Korlock, which is so popular, to something of lead-free? Is the performance at the target going to be roughly the same, or can they expect to burn through a box of ammo, reworking the optics a little bit to dial it in better?
You know, I would say it depends. Your point of impact is almost certainly going to be different. If you have a good rifle, if you're a good shot, if you're careful, this is the sort of thing where you could, easily zero your rifle as long as you don't run into major problems with, say, you know, 6-8 rounds, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it shouldn't be a giant issue.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good to know, because to me, I'm relying on people like yourself. In this case, you're telling me about this lead-free ammo. Yeah, I was somewhat familiar, but that was about it. That's intriguing me a lot to say that the performance of that round, not just at the rifle, not just at the shooter, but also in offering a clean kill, but it doesn't stop there, also offering a clean processing of the meat, less damage, less concern about fragments, etc. That just makes sense. That's a great package situation to highly consider for most calibers, I would think.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, I would tell people, you know, there's nothing wrong with lead core ammo. If you want to use it, and if it's legal for you to use it, you know, you're in Michigan, so I'm sure it is. People live in California, they have to use lead-free ammo, so they don't have a choice. That's a story for another day, though, but as long as it's legal.
Yeah, we don't have enough time in
no
the day.
At all not to use it.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting, because... Well, folks, I told you so. Hey, this is a wonderful podcast with John. John, what an expert he is. But, hey, this podcast could have went on for hours, and we did get into a lot of information. We had to, kind of call it a day, so to speak, when we got to a certain point. But that caused us to split this podcast up into parts one and parts two. This pretty much wraps up part one. And we're going to repost, post part two up in about a week. All right. Hey, we really appreciate you dialing into this podcast. Hey, we kind of ended on that note. Some of us get a little frustrated with what's good for one state that seems to want to bleed itself out or to the rest of us. No pun intended, but they like to force feed the rest of us to do just because of what they're doing. But I can see a little bit of a point here on the lead-free ammo. We'll see what's going on with this as time goes on. But hey, I'm all about performance of that on the ballistic side, as John is. You can sense that with him. He's a strong proponent of performance. All right. Hey, thanks for dialing in. Take care.
This week's podcast brought to you by M65 Bait Shop 2, located just before the boat launch in Agrès, is now open, offering all your fishing supplies for catching that big one. They are your walleye headquarters of the Northeast, with the largest selection of custom bandits in northern Michigan. Stop in at either of their locations, the M65 Bait Shop Whittemore and the M65 Bait Shop 2 in Agrès, located just before the DNR boat launch. Open 7 days a week, from 8 to 4, veteran owned. And also brought to you by
Michigan Brand. Michigan Brand is a third-generation, family-owned and operated business out of mid-Michigan. We are known for our world-famous hams, jerky, and various sausage products. You can find us all over the state of Michigan, as well as other states throughout the U.S. Check us out at MichiganBrand.net. That's MichiganBrand.net to learn more.
And with that, we conclude another podcast episode with Wild Game Dynasty. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe in your podcast app to receive notifications on future podcasts. Also, please head on over and check out our Facebook page. Be sure to like and follow it to stay up to date on highlights from our clients, turkey, bear, and white-tailed deer hunts. Until next time, guys, stay safe, enjoy the great outdoors, and happy hunting.